I think, you know, I have read that you've been involved in a number of industries, such as air traffic control and computing. And I was just wanting to ask you a little bit about your early professional years, because I think that it might be of interest to know where you would come to in such a position related to leadership.
Well, so it is a bit checkered. And in my first university department, at an appraisal meeting with my head of department, he said, a key thing you need to do is decide on a specialism and stick to it. And I said, that's problematic for me because I'm interested in lots of different things and I tend to get bored very easily. So sticking with one is a problem. Now, I suppose where I come from is applied psychology. And applied psychology, if you look at it, has always had a struggle to retain the same level of academic credibility as more pure psychologists would argue. I think it's crucial, and I'm part of my sort of career rationale, although it tends to be retrospective rationales, is really to see application of theory and research and models to practice. That's what I'm about. And I started a journal called Health Services Management Research, which I've been editor of for about 27 years now. And the first editorial I wrote in there was about how work settings and academia ought to relate to each other in a much more positive way, rather than being reasonably hostile to each other. So academia is seen as slightly ivory tower and irrelevant, and the work setting is seen as sort of filthy lucre and you're just after profit and why don't you go and study things properly. So they've got a sort of an antagonistic type of approach to each other, and I think that they could both benefit from working together. So my approach has been to try and make application of different research and understanding of problems. And what I'm fundamentally as a researcher is an applied problem solver. And that will become relevant, I think, if the argument is coherent, as to why I end up looking at issues of leadership for particularly doctors, but other clinicians who transfer into a managerial or leadership role and then are faced with a number of issues for which they've really no particular training other than their knowledge of service delivery and perhaps their particular specialty. But the problems of management and leadership tend to be broader than that. So they're going outside of their expertise base into solving problems. And you then say, well, on what basis would they be solving a problem? And this then starts to define the nature of management or leadership and that transition that people need to make in order to tackle problems that are outside a narrowly defined expertise. And what I have is a very broadly defined expertise. So it's the application of research methods, inquiry methods, sort of stroke consultancy type methodologies to a range of problems. So what I look at is the nature of the problems that people have in different industries, hence my sort of travel across a range of different industries. So I've worked very largely in universities, in different departments. I've worked in applied psychology departments. I've worked in management schools, and I've worked in medical schools. So it's the range, which is slightly unusual in terms of academic career, of taking a wider perspective on the nature of the issues that those different settings encounter, rather than specific expertise in the basis of each of those separate disciplines. And that's, I think, what I'm trying to bring. So when I say work in air traffic control, it was particularly around a computer aiding project. So what we were trying to do was to understand how a computer aiding system could help controllers under heavy work pressures. And that would have some relevance to you, I think, in your particular understanding of experimental psychology. Because the psychology of air traffic control is very much about construction of mental models, but this time almost graphical mental models. They have a picture of the movement of aircraft across sectors, and often quite complex, very fast moving, and very interacting sort of pathways and flights and things. And we built the computer aiding system with a view to total computerization of air traffic control on the basis it would be safer. You'd have multiple computer systems backing this up should one go down.
So can I ask when this was? Because one would imagine the transition into a computer-supported system would have been very necessary given the technological capability. Yeah.
This was late 80s.
Right.
And what we were sort of stopped, not in our tracks, but the controllers themselves started to say, understand what you're trying to do, but if anything goes wrong, we sort of need about 10 minutes to reconstruct this model. Mm. And we're not going to get 10 minutes. So what we want is a computer that's going to reduce a lot of our repetitive stuff, but not stop us controlling the dynamic of the flows. So that should we want to intervene, should we decide to intervene, we have a manual override. We can come back into that system, take over and change it. So I say it because I'm no longer a specialist in air traffic control at all, but it's the application of both how do you create that mental picture, it's understanding that, how does it then apply to what the computer designers are trying to do, and me as a sort of interface between the people who are my main interest, the workforce, because I come as an applied psychologist to that workforce, and the context in which they work, and the particular issue that they're tackling at the moment, which might be computer aiding. Mm. And I came to computer aiding in air traffic control, having worked previously for a company in Norway called Norske Veritas, which is a bit like Lloyd's. They insure shipping. I was a sort of research fellow there, looking at shipping accidents and why they occur. Mm. And what we developed there was a sort of black box that similar to that exists on aircraft, but for shipping. And the dilemma with shipping, of course, is that it's much slower. So you could be on, you know, one of these enormous tankers. You could be there for a month, 6 weeks doing this. So that black box is incredibly boring.
I was going to say the frame rate must be particularly low.
Now, but it's again, it's the model of what causes accidents.
Yes.
How would you know what's happening that led to this accident? Whether it was a minor grounding, a shipping. I was doing work up and down the Norwegian coast, which could be a minor sea going vessel. It could be a passenger. It could be a fishing vessel. To the big tankers, mm-hmm. and why do they go off track? And they take, you know, almost days to turn around. They take hours to actually shift their course. So what are the processes that people are using? So one of the themes perhaps emerging is I like to work through the concept of mental models. And that for me is the diversity of my thinking. I'm less sort of involved in diversity as it's currently understood, which is about people and origins, as diversity as different mental models. Because I think that's the key to a lot of conflicts, a lot of misunderstanding, and a lot of work problems, is that people are thinking about things in a different way. And because they think about them in a different way, they don't necessarily have the language to describe their processes to somebody else who thinks about them differently. Mm. So they're sort of at odds. Without having interpersonal conflict, they don't see the thing in the same way.
Do you think that that's an innate characteristic, or do you think it's something that is cultural, or something that is learned or can be instilled in training? Because that will very much come on to how people develop
as
leaders.
Exactly. I think there's got to be some degree of personal style quality that makes people's brain systems work slightly differently. They have a preference for seeing things in certain ways.
And that's very much part of their own personal upbringing
And that'll be, you know, the crossover between their genetic endowment, their experiences and all that sort of stuff. And I'm not saying you can get rid of that, but there is a tremendous interaction with that. with, I think, subsequent training. And that's where I think if there's a contribution to the way doctors are trained and then work in these wider contexts, they're not typically trained into that wider context. So the training tends to be expert-based training, tends to be on the basis of acquisition of knowledge. And I think, you know, it's changing a little bit with some of the professional bodies talking about societal medicine, and in the 21st century it'll be more about people, especially elderly, who have a range of conditions and need to be managed rather than cured. So there will be a broadening, I think, but traditionally it's come from a very knowledge base. Now that is different, I think, from the managerial perspective, which tends to be a more collective base, a more sort of, well, I'm making that decision on behalf of this organisation for most people, as opposed to the individualistic knowledge-based approach of medicine, which says, I'm seeing this patient in this consultation,
with this particular
I'm bringing
problem.
This problem to bear, and I'm making that decision, and that's the best decision I can make. And with only limited subsequent exposure to the implicative decisions that go on around that patient. So it's been slightly narrowed, and I think it's beginning to take on that wider perspective.
And certainly,
that's
certainly
what we've done here.
Exactly, and that's certainly what I've picked up in the book so far. And in fact, one of the very interesting chapters, which I really enjoyed reading, was, the ones that I've read so far, was the chapter on the differences between managers and doctors, because it's a very classical theme, and you know, to do with the title of the book itself, From Dark Side to Centre Stage. And I personally felt that out of that, and I scripted it as a bit of a battle between the two, that the managers very much seemed to have taken a hard time from it and seemed to be doing their very best to bring this broader perspective to the medical staff, which are being slightly narrow-minded and maybe a bit blinkered about it.
Well, both that and sometimes degrees of self-interest or degrees of not wishing to go there, because I think we have to recognise that it would be constraining. The collective view would. And we tried to raise this, that the issue for many doctors is around clinical freedom and clinical autonomy. And it's a true dilemma, because as a patient, you want your doctor largely to exercise unbridled clinical freedom. So if you think that the best treatment for this particular patient is this, it's difficult to articulate how, as a patient, you want that doctor to be saying, yeah, but if I choose this, I might be infringing my capacity to make other decisions for other patients later on. So I won't go down that absolutely ideal route. I'll go to my next best. Now, that's a real dilemma, ethical dilemma, because if that's not the best and it's constrained for whatever reason, and the obvious one would be finances, but it could be constrained for, well, there are different ways of treating this and we could do it differently. You're balancing off something that's been absolutely implicit and to a degree explicit in medicine, that you do your best for the patient.
Yes, and you're not, it's a trade-off.
If you're not quite doing your best, for many doctors that's just a no-no. Like, I can't see how you would do that. For managers, of course, they're coming from the other end of the dimension of, yes, we'd like to do our best for patients, but all patients. So that might, for me, require a trade-off. But the difficulty is, of course, most managers are not in the position of making the decisions that allocate the resource where the trade-off implication would occur. So they've got to influence the clinical judgment, and that again produces another tension where the doctor says, well, actually, you haven't been trained in this, so why would you be a reasonable person to be influencing this decision I'm making about this patient? And of course, they're all right, and that's why we're trying to argue, certainly at the end, that the notion of duality is what we're trying to move towards, not a dominance of one group over another, but a recognition of those perspective differences and how can they be reconciled into a better system. So what we don't want, and particularly John and I have worked together more so than Chris, what we've worked together to try and do is not to train doctors as managers. Mm. We don't see that as appropriate because there are many competent managers, some less competent, but there are many competent ones. Why would you waste, you know, 5 to 8 years training as a doctor to say, well, now you need to train as a manager? What we really want is to bring the perspective of the doctor to the managerial context, which is healthcare.
Mm.
And it's the marrying of those perspectives, or at least the recognition in a respectful way, that we're both trying to do something here, and that if they're in conflict, we have to try and reconcile them. And that disparaging managers because they're not giving patients care is not fair, because that's not their job.
Mm.
And similarly, managers saying, oh, it's the doctors again, you know, they're using non-generic drugs and they're doing this and that, is also not fair, because they're following their perspective. Mm. It is that, and for me, you see, we've gone back now to where I come from this multiple perspectives, different ways of thinking, different ways of understanding the problem, and if you differ, you're not going to agree with how somebody else sees the problem. So that's where I come from.
So just picking up on those, on that very background again, is it very much a question that from your own personal career you found that you've been able to take those experiences, those different ways of thinking, and develop your own personal appreciation of how these work in an academic sense?
Yeah.
In particular, how this has culminated in being related to healthcare management.
Yeah, I haven't always worked in the healthcare sector, which I think is probably a slight advantage, probably in the current climate, useful too, to understand the perspectives of other sectors. But without sort of arrogantly saying, yeah, I understand the perspective of all these people I've encountered, what I'm actually coming to those different people and sectors is with a degree of humble ignorance. I'm actually saying, I don't understand your expertise, so I don't know why you make that decision. Now, what I then bring is a range of more formal analytic techniques, which might include things like process mapping or assessing levels of risk in a care pathway, which are quite formal assessment techniques, to a more informal, more intuitive judgment, where I'm using, I suspect, a range of experiences to pick up, okay, that's how you see it. Talk to one of your colleagues, and in my mind, I now know that they don't see it like this. So my contribution, for example, I might and have been brought into some medical teams who've been warring for years and they won't work together, they use different protocols, the nursing staff are sort of tearing their hair out about, well, it's been Mr. Watson's name, but it's Mr. Johnson, and we have to do things.
They're not real characters, I think.
Not real characters, but one can imagine they might exist.
Okay. And they sound like they're surgeons as well.
Well, some of them are. But it's this process of, okay, well, you are doing it differently. Now, I'm being brought in to try and get you to work more collaboratively. And you can say, well, how will I do that? And I think that's not an appeal to knowledge, because they have the knowledge and I don't. So there's got to be a meta sort of process appeal in there about you are working across a system with other colleagues who are unclear about the delivery, which could raise some patient safety type issues. It could even raise, and has done in some instances, GMC-type issues, because unsafe care can be prompted by poor team working as much as it can from, I've not made the right decision. And so once the GMC starts to recognise collaborative working as a requirement, then I have another lever. So I'll bring these people together, often in very tense rooms, where I'm going to expose the underlying philosophy differences, and I'm going to ask for reconciliation in a pure sense, I suppose.
Mm.
But I may not do that quite as upfront, because that really sounds a little bit that we're going to a religious meeting or something. But what I'm really doing is saying, I've picked up some differences the way you work here, and I'll be challenging them to understand each other's difference, and then look at why are we still doing these differences? I mean, why do they still exist? I might use some leverage from a senior nurse about, you know, this is a real problem. One of my junior nurses just didn't know what to do. And see if I can almost create the momentum of the argument about why you should change. Because I don't have to change. I'm not there. They do.
Is it naive of me to think of this in the almost as in the, like the framework of a counselling session?
It can get close to counselling. Some of those individuals will want to talk about themselves and their colleagues and will want to tell me why it's inappropriate for me to get them to switch and all this.
And that could be from a very close personal attachment and emotional attachment to the service that they provide.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And therefore, it's not a right or wrong. I can't come along and say, oh, yeah, I think you need to change. Yeah. I've got to ask them to think about that attachment and where is it really coming from. Mm-hmm. And if somebody else is equally attached to something different, are we saying that this is sort of a complete range of care that is available to everybody? Can everybody just make it up? Mm. You know, why does your college bother with guidelines? It's pointless, really, isn't it? Because you're over here and you're over here, and neither of you are paying any attention to these guidelines. So, and in a sense, the patient safety movement has created something of an opportunity around this. And I tend to challenge the medical profession a bit with patient safety sort of really became big time in the 90s. And you could argue from a public perspective, were we not making the assumption that patient safety was always a priority? Well, sort of yes, but then why did we have a patient safety movement that was required to promote guidelines, to, you know, build up the IHI saving 1,000, you know, sort of where did that come from if it really was implicit? And of course, we're now getting into that territory again of clinical freedom to practice in the way that you think is best. Is that clinical freedom, or is that potentially unsafe practice? And who knows what the difference is?
Sounds like regulation has and revalidation has something to do with this, maybe.
Yeah, well, it pops up.
Yes. Yeah.